Hello, this is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian Dwyer. With me in the studio, Deb Bradfield. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks, Brian.
On this wintry day.
Yes, haven't seen you for ages.
Yeah, and Tony Webber. How are you, Tony?
Good, thanks, Brian. And how are you?
Quite well for yes. such a winter's day.
And you're still happy about Saturday?
I am. I'm still smiling about the Bulldogs' victory, yes. Mm. It's been a long time since May 1962 when I first discovered the Western Bulldogs.
Is that why you... Oh, no. When did they win the... When
54
was that?
54.
54, oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry, I thought you might have just jumped on the bandwagon when they won a...
No.
Won something.
1954. I remember 1954, but I don't remember that actual game.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a very, very long time. Yes, so in football terms, I don't know how long they can sustain this manic brand of football. Somebody will write a book about it, Deb.
That's
yeah,
right.
I don't know enough about football really to know why it's manic. It just looks like every regular game of football to me, with everybody, you know, sort of bruising everybody else and collapsing in heaps and...
Yeah, well, I think just in football terms, the Dogs always try to get an extra man where the ball is, which is, you know, pretty hard work.
Oh, I see. So dashing all over the field.
Yeah. No doubt Robert Murphy, the injured Bulldogs captain, will write a book about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually,
we'll review it.
I googled him later because I thought, who is that guy they keep putting...
They're all fussing about.
Yes. And I thought, how come he's holding up the cup? He wasn't even there.
he's the poet of the halfback flank.
Is he? Oh.
Spiritual leader.
Oh, right.
Oh, he writes a very entertaining column in The Age, which is barely about football.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, actually, I did then read that in the Saturday Age he was writing.
This is, in fact, the book show.
Did anyone bring a book about football?
No.
Later on, we'll be talking not only to Deb Bradfield and Tony Webber, but to Monique Gillam and Lee Kelly about the Bildung's Roman, the coming-of-age novel. But before we get to that, Deb, what have you been up to lately?
Yes, well, I'm reading A Voyage for Madmen, very aptly named it is too, by a fellow called Peter Nichols. And it's an account of the 1968 Round the World Golden Globe Yacht Race.
Voyage for Madmen.
Look, honestly, they really were mad, absolutely mad, because there were nine people went in this race. And looking at each of those people, we'll do a chapter on one person and how they prepared for the race. And there was one guy who'd never sailed in his life before who went in it. So the reason was that Chichester had recently done Around the World, but he'd stopped in Australia.
Yes.
And so a couple of people then wanted to do one better and actually get around single-handed non-stop.
Yes.
So a few people had the idea to start at around about the same time and then sort of heard about each other and inadvertently it turned into a race. It wasn't really meant to be one in the first place, but it sort of evolved into one. And
were they British eccentrics?
Yeah, totally. So there was the one that had never sailed before. So as soon as he lost sight of land, he was lost.
They're like the people you meet at Cooper Pedy who've driven all that way without a spare tyre or something. You know,
And they've got away with it.
Yeah. They tend to, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, no, unfortunately, not all of these guys got away with it.
No, right.
And in fact, at the beginning of the book, there are nine of them, and we've got a chapter on each of them getting ready, and you think, well, how am I going to be able to follow these nine people? It's all a bit confusing. Yeah. But fortunately for the reader, two of them sort of drop out fairly early without actually dying, which is good.
They rescued a great expense to the taxpayer.
No, look, that never happened. See, this was in the time when there was virtually no communications. Mm. I mean, there were some radios, but most of them, their radios conked out in the very early days, because these people were going to sea in boats that I would not even sail pretty much around, you know, Port Phillip.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Mm. One guy set sail in a trimaran made of plywood. You know, he was going down to the roaring 40s.
Yeah.
It was just, they really were insane.
Amateurs, yeah.
Well, there were a couple of professionals in it, and of course they were the ones that managed to finish. Well, really only one actually finished, and he, of course, won. And he wrote a book about his exploits. I had written, I had read some of the other accounts of this race from the view of the people that were in it. So Mortessier was one of them, and Robin Knox Johnson. So it's a great read. Not just armchair sailors, really, for anyone, just to see, you know, what people do attempt and, well, what they used to attempt. You know, I don't know, you'd probably be stopped from going these days. They wouldn't let you, you know. But it was fascinating.
You've kind of reminded me of Eddie the Eagle. Do you know? He was a person who, I think, attended the Olympic Games.
Eddie the Eel, was it?
No, the Eagle. A different man, similar thing.
Mm.
Eddie the Eagle went in the whatever it's called, the ski jumping.
Right.
But he didn't know how to do it. He wasn't an expert, but he was an entrant in the Olympic competition.
Oh, fantastic.
Nearly killed himself.
So he must have qualified. He must have qualified in order to get
it. Well, I think he might have, I don't know, he might have represented Romania or somebody and they just let him. I don't know. I don't quite know the story, but there seems to be a genre of people doing foolhardy, reckless things.
Yeah, with no experience.
Yeah, extraordinary. But, very good read. I'm only, two-thirds of the way through.
Hmm.
And I sort of know how it does end up because I'd read some of the other accounts. There was one guy in it who actually just pretended to go. He was completely insane. Cheated. And he pretended to go around the world. Yeah. He just stayed in the Atlantic for 6 months, going around and around.
It's not a Monty Python book.
No. Well, that's the amazing thing about it, because these people existed. But he actually ended up committing suicide because he couldn't face the shame of what he'd done.
Yeah. Hiding.
Mm. So it's amazing, the people out there on the water.
True than fiction.
Well,
thank you, Deb. We've got a couple to get through before we get Lee in. Tony Weber, what's that book you're reading?
This is Rachel Robinson's Leading on the Edge, about a woman who ends up, she's sort of got involved with national parks and all that in Victoria as a young woman and got a mentor that's given her a lot of responsibility. Mm. She's ending up being in charge of lots of middle-aged men, which they resent. But she does manage it, you know. And you can imagine this is back in the 80s and 90s. Yes. It's not, you know, a little less enlightened. And then she gets a job to go and lead a group down to Antarctica. Well, she's one of, I think there was 13 people applying for the job, all males, and she was the only female, and she got it. Well, so you could imagine, you know, it's extraordinary, you know. And living in the really difficult conditions, locked in for weeks with blizzards and, you know, and all the tensions that are involved and trying to keep everyone from strangling each other, you know.
Yeah. And is it on the continent?
On the continent, yeah.
Casey
yeah.
or one of those.
Yeah. yeah. Mm. So fascinating. And she's now giving lectures on leadership, you know, on good title too, Leading on the Edge.
A scientific expedition, presumably.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. But she's in charge of the whole thing, you know.
Yeah, the leader doesn't necessarily have to have scientific skills.
Oh, okay.
For instance, Neil Roberts, the footballer.
Just to bring that in again.
Was a leader of such an expedition.
Oh, okay. Mm. Ah, didn't realise that.
And not quite sure what Neil's trade was, but he certainly worked as a journalist.
Fascinating book. Rachel Robinson.
That's a play on words, isn't it? Leading on the edge.
Really.
Leading edge.
Yes. Well, very much on the edge, you know, the edge of everything. Yeah.
Yes.
So, two non-fiction books, interesting.
But about, you know, coming of age, her learning to do things that probably someone 20 years older would have been learning. She's learned how to do this, even as a child, you know, so.
Did she talk, you've reminded me, I read somewhere recently, there was a woman touring Australia talking about the process of applying for jobs and how that was more difficult for women because of biases built into the normal process. For instance, the skills advertised for tended to require a man. Anyway, she was a very high flying executive with, you know, one of those multinational companies. So that was quite an interesting article in the paper. I couldn't.
So was that saying that they actually write the ad in that way in order to exclude women, or it's just that they're the qualities they want?
Both of those. Both, I think, of those things. There's a bias towards cultural male behaviour in the job descriptions. There's also a bias against people who have any caring responsibilities, and a number of other things. Yeah, might have another look at it for another day. Tony's Cloud Atlas. Reminds me of my trip to the Cape Otway Lighthouse, where the gentleman actually showed me his cloud atlas on the wall.
All the different clouds.
Categories.
Oh, right. Is it that kind of book? No, it's not. It's a very far-fetched, you know, and spread over many centuries and many different time, you know, like situations.
Right.
But all linked in the book, you're linked by your past life. So as immediately you die, you're into a new life.
And
it's transposed into the future, but you're following basically what you did before.
Recurrence.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. And the filming of it was just, I don't know how they ever did. They said it would be absolutely impossible to film.
This is a feature film.
Yeah, a feature film, as well as the book, yeah.
Really?
And they said it's just not possible to film such a thing. They had the actors playing six parts, each part of those, you know, as they transferred from one life to the other, they'd be in another form and doing a similar thing again.
Yes.
Just, you know, and they had to have two full production teams to actually run it, and the coordination to have the two full production teams and actually working together was just, you know, they don't know how they did it, but they did, and the film is brilliant. So
does that mean we learn nothing and we just come back in the next life and do exactly the same thing as we did?
Sort of, but it's a slightly different situation, but no. Over many generations, we do seem to get somewhere.
Oh, right. Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Because finally they're off Earth and they're in this, and they're looking back at Earth. There's this lovely blue place, you know. Talking to this grandfather's talking to all these granddaughters. He only seems to have granddaughters, masses of them, you know. And there he is with them and saying, and they're living very simple life and a lovely life, you know, compared to all the other lives that they've been through that have been pretty horrendous.
So the evolutionary process is gradually making the male redundant.
Well, not that might be a take on. I didn't think of that. Yes,
we always knew that would happen.
Superfluous.
Yeah. So the Cloud Atlas, David.
Yeah, I might read that.
David Mitchell. That's not the BBC comedian, David Mitchell.
Not that I know.
Different
of,
person.
No. Yeah.
And you have another book there.
Oh, well, that's a guide to CD guide for the radio station. Classical tunes from John Carger, if everyone remembers John Carger.
I do.
Yes.
I do.
His voice, I always remember his voice.
Yes.
Singers of renown.
Before we call in Lee Kelly and Monique, I did promise people that I would look something up a couple of weeks ago. I read the Sherlock Holmes book, The House of Silk, and it was written by Anthony Horowitz, who was commissioned by the estate of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to write a new Sherlock Holmes book about 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, really? Gee.
And it's very good. Very good.
Gee.
So, The House of Silk by Anthony Horowitz. Our focus this week is the Bildungsroman, the novel about the psychological and moral growth of the protagonist from youth to adult, a coming-of-age novel. A novel of formation or education. The term was coined in 1819 by Karl Morgenstern, whom I believe was German, and it was later made popular by a person called Wilhelm Dilthey. And the coming-of-age novel was made famous by Johann Wolfgang Goethe's Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, which was published in 1796 when Jane Austen was a girl. That's Lee Kelly. You can hear in the background. How are you, Lee?
I'm very well, actually. I've got a bit of a cold, so excuse my froggy voice.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that we'd be talking about books today, Brian. I thought we might have stayed with football.
Oh, there is a lot to say about football.
Yes.
Hello, Monique Gillam. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Now, I just wanted to make a general kind of distinction, Lee, although academic people could make lots of distinctions. The sort of Bildungsroman can be about training and formal education. It can be about the development of an artist. It could be about a person who suffers a loss and has to leave home. I dare say it could also be a form of the quest novel, as indeed the film Star Wars is when his name is, Luke has to leave home. It could be a clash between the protagonist's needs and desires and the current social norms. But here's the interesting thing, that sometimes the young person adapts successfully to the prevailing values of society. And people argue that Dickens' Great Expectations, that Pip actually does conform in the end. Whereas in other books, the person doesn't conform. So when we say coming-of-age novel, sometimes it's about the induction of a person into society, and sometimes it's, I think, a book of rebellion in which the rebellion's not actually resolved.
Yeah, and I think some writers use it specifically to explore those sort of social norms or social situations, and so the coming of age is that person sort of wrestling with this feature of society that they don't like or is restricting to them, and in the journey of the young person, we as a reader explore how we feel about that aspect of society. But then it can also be about, there's quite a few of these I was thinking that are about the things that happen to us as children and how we come to terms with them, you know, the importance of those things. And I was thinking about this on the way in, how that resonates today with, you know, the stories of refugee children and the impact of those events on young lives. I think that this genre does look at that, you know, how we resolve those things of childhood.
Psychologically, do you mean? Yes. And how we recover from our childhood.
Yeah, or don't.
Yes, or don't. We'll come perhaps back to it later, but just to illustrate my point, I would think that Jane Austen's Emma is an example of the young person who grows up and learns that she's been behaving childishly, and now when she behaves like an adult, she'd be worthy of, you know, the commendable man.
Yes, yes.
Mr. Knightley, I think it is. That's an example of one. Whereas The Catcher in the Rye, for instance, didn't leave me feeling that Holden Caulfield was going to become a successful advertising executive in New York.
Yeah,
you know, I didn't think that his induction into society was going to be resolved. So, we've spoken about this book before, but I see Monique has a J.K. Rowling book in front of her. Now, is this, does this fall into the coming of age, do you think? Tell us what the basic story skeleton is, please, Monique. Does it fit in, do you think?
If you Google it, it does. Oh, all the Harry Potters are there. All of them.
Oh, are they? They're all sagas or stories of coming of age.
Hmm. Yeah, although this one takes the his son, doesn't it?
Yeah,
This is where I was, and I remain at a complete disadvantage, Lee, because I absolutely know nothing about anything beyond the Philosopher's Stone. That's the extent of my knowledge.
Okay, BD, we have a lot of knowledge here.
Tell us what happens. Who's coming of age? Harry's son. And I dare say he's got a very entertaining name.
His name is Albus Sirius after Dumbledore and Snape. And it sort of follows him on his... It starts off where the last book sort of ended in the flash to the future. So it starts with Harry's son going off to Hogwarts, and then he gets sorted into Slytherin, which is a huge disappointment because he wanted to be in Gryffindor like his dad. And then it's sort of all these mishaps that happen along the way that...
So he's disappointed, yes, and he comes to terms to it, comes to terms with it, no doubt, in the end. And I dare say he has an arch rival.
Yes and no. He makes friends with Malfoy's son, which is unexpected, and Harry doesn't really approve of that friendship, but there's not really somebody, like, because Voldemort obviously isn't in it, there's sort of not a clear enemy until towards the end when it's revealed somebody who they trusted was actually had other motives.
But it's also like, you know, that thing about finding your own way in the world.
Yeah,
like,
he feels lost and not validated. And
yeah, because he struggles with the expectations of who he is and his family. And but I thought that was interesting, that bit about the sort of main event involves him trying to rectify a wrong that he sees.
Yeah.
So it's like almost as if the morals...
Did he commit the wrong?
No. He kind of... Though unlike the other Harry Potters, he goes looking for the adventure and he very much puts himself in harm's way, whereas with Harry, he never really did that. The trouble always found him, whereas his son kind of seeks it out and goes...
But it's sort of like that old story of youth with the idealism, you know, this is wrong and I can't put up with it, I have to write this. And then the voice of experience coming over the top and saying, silly boy, there's more to this than meets the eye.
So does he end up taking a more pragmatic view or not? Or does his idealism remain?
I don't know.
He learns a lesson. He kind of... Because it's in play form, so it's not really in first person, it's not inside his head or anything, at one point the focus sort of gets taken off him and put on his best friend, Malfoy's son. And so in that area, he kind of is the one who pieces it together and goes back and says to Albus, like, you know, we can't meddle with something we don't understand. We've got to take a step back and respect that this is something that is bigger than us.
Now, you mentioned it's in play form, and the authors are J. Tiffany and Jack Thorne, as well as J.K. Rowling. So I imagine this is one of those blockbusters in London where you can't get a seat for the next 2 years or something.
Yes, apparently the play is. But what did you think of that, Monique? Because when I reviewed this book, I was talking about how I thought that the play form didn't suit it because it was a story. You know, and a play needs an interplay between characters rather than to be driven by events. You know, like when the Dementors appear, and it just doesn't seem right as a sort of a stage direction.
True. I actually found initially I was disappointed by the play form, and I expected it to be like released as a novel as well. But then reading it, I sort of found it really easy to, like, the flow of it was kept up, and it was kind of easier, like better to picture inside your mind as the film. And I found it flowed really well. And yeah, I liked it in play form.
Maybe that's because we're so familiar with the world and the characters.
True.
You know, maybe if it had been a one-off, it wouldn't have worked so well.
If it was the first book or if it was just starting out, then it wouldn't, But I feel like they sort of got away with it based on the premise that, we knew what was going on.
So you know what the $64 million question will be? Has she left enough wriggle room for the next one?
And will it be a stage show again or not?
There's certainly elements of the story that could be picked up, I think. Yeah. So I don't know whether they're setting up for another dynasty or not.
I'm sure they will. Before we go to our break, Lee, shall we just get you to tell us about one of these books that's been published in the last 15 or 16 years or so in that period, because the genre, as we said, is, 240 years old or something, you mathematicians, but nevertheless they keep publishing Bildungsroman, don't
yeah
they?
I think that's it's interesting. Like, genre is always, like as a way of discussing books, it's not terribly engaging, I suppose, but it's always interesting to think about why these type of books are so popular. And I think it's that sort of personal journey, but also, like we said, that exploration of society. And the one I'm going to talk about is actually by the same writer as Tony's book that he discussed, Cloud Atlas, David Mitchell. And this book was recommended to me by a friend who was a librarian, and he loved it, and I absolutely loved it. It's called Black Swan Green, published in 2006 by an English writer, and it's basically the story of a boy who's 13, I think, at the start, and it's a year in his life, and each chapter is sort of a different month. And look, it's just so beautifully written, and it's so engaging of our memories of childhood. Like, it covers so many things that would relate to people's lives. For example, the boy Jason, I mean, he just lives in this ordinary English house. He's got a sister and a mum and a dad, but he stammers, and he calls the stammer Hangman. And so as he's writing, he'll talk about, well, I couldn't say that word because Hangman's got that one. And he treats it like as if it's a person. But he goes through all the horrors of childhood, like breaking something valuable. He breaks his grandfather's watch, and he's, terrified to tell anybody about it, and goes through all these lengths so no one discovers, and is constantly searching to see if he can find another one.
So is it told in the first person?
Yeah, he tells the story about his life.
So it's a novel written like a memoir.
Yeah, sort of. I suppose that's it. But he also talks about, bullying at school by not just the kids, but the teachers. Yeah. How the teachers sort of sided he's gone to the British school, and there's the gangs and so forth. And, the teacher that wants to be popular and sides with the popular kids.
Yes.
It was really interesting take on that. And, gangs and secrets and his first sexual awakenings, like there's a girl that hangs around in the gang and she's more like a boy.
Yeah.
But, he's attracted to her, and his agonies that he goes through with that. It's just beautiful. I was just going to read a tiny little piece of it, if I can, about he's out with the gang and his friend's trying to get him to have a cigarette. But there's another reason why you must smoke this cigarette. Not because it's the first step to becoming someone your turkey-shagging schoolmates will respect instead of exploit. Not because a young blood with a mature cigarette is a better proposition to the ladies than a boy with a sherbet dip. It's this. Come here. I'll whisper it. Hugo leant so close his lips touched my ears and 10,000 volts sang all over my nervous system. For a split second, I had a vision of Hugo, the oarsman out in the water, cathedrals and riverbanks blurring by, biceps stiffening and loosening under his vest, with girlfriends lining the river, girlfriends ready to lick him where he told them. If you don't kill, not today, Hugo did a horror movie trailer voice, one day you'll wake up, look in the mirror and see Brian and Uncle Michael. It's really a good example of the sort of logic that's used. Not that I'm encouraging anybody to smoke cigarettes, but also the one about the stammer is fantastic. Mm. And he says at the end about, and he explores that. He says, "I hadn't stammered once the whole time I've been talking to Mrs. Greeton. Suppose it isn't a hangman who causes it. Suppose it's the other person, the other person's expectations. Suppose that's why I can read aloud in an empty room perfectly, or to a horse or a dog or myself. Or Mrs. Greeton, who mightn't have been listening to a voice, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't mine. Suppose there's a time fuse lit when it's a human listening, like a stick of Tom and Jerry dynamite. Suppose if you don't get the word out before this fuse is burnt away, a couple of seconds, say, the dynamite goes off. Suppose what triggers the stammers, the stress of hearing that fuse going sss. Suppose you could make that fuse infinitely long, so long that the dynamite would never go off. How?" It's just...
Yeah.
Style, it's just about growing up, really. And at the end of it, his parents divorce and he leaves the house and he has to leave his home. And he describes that too. It's beautifully written.
That's so interesting. I'm just trying to imagine in my head how that's written. Like a first person in the present. And
it's just telling what's happening as going along.
That is interesting.
And especially when you consider it to the complexity of his other novel, Cloud Atlas.
Mm.
You know, it's really very different style. Yeah.
But then, it's no surprise that there are many novels of a growing up, because such a complex and difficult process.
Well, I think at the end of this, he sort of makes a point, because he's had these secrets, you know, he had to hide the watch that he broke, and he realises that his parents' marriage breaking down has been their secret. And it's like that growing up thing, realising that your parents are real people and then they have real events in their lives and understanding that from a different perspective.
Yes. Black Swan Green by David Mitchell. Been joined again by Deb Bradfield. My name's Brian. I'm here with Lee Kelly and Tony Webber. The Kite Runner, Lee, that a lot of people know that because it's been on school reading lists.
Yeah, famous film too.
But again, as you were saying before, such an interesting idea about having to right a wrong.
Yeah, that idea of something that happens in your youth. People don't know the story, you know, it's two young boys, one rich, one poor, one Pashtun and one Hazar, growing up in Afghanistan with the backdrop of all the political instability. And there's a pivotal scene where there's an act of violence against one of the children that's quite horrific, really. And his friend, Amir, who tells the story, fails to prevent it. And then the thing that's really interesting about it too is in the way of a child, he also tries to protect himself from discovery, you know, in the way children do. They sort of dig themselves in further. And so he has to get rid of the evidence of his crime. So he sort of implicates his friend in stealing, and that way the family are removed from his world, so he doesn't see them anymore and he's not reminded of what happened. It's just interesting because it really captures that logic of a child. Like, he hadn't done anything wrong. He just hadn't acted to protect his friend. And he couldn't stand that memory of it, so he actually does do something wrong, trying to rid himself of his guilt. And then, of course, in later years, he gets a chance for redemption, because he can go back to Afghanistan and help rescue the child of the friend that he had wronged. So it's about sort of how those events in childhood can scar you, because they can make you see yourself in a way that makes you feel different from the rest of people in society.
Mm.
And it's a long journey back.
Yeah.
You can't sort of quite rid yourself of it. But also I thought interesting in it too was that, one of his motivations for not interfering in the first place was he wanted to take the kite back because he knew it meant a lot to his father. He wanted that approval of his father.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is also a common theme.
Yeah, but also that, you know, like we were saying before about how you can, you think you understand what society is as a child, but you don't really understand it because you can't see all the back scenes and...
Yes. And Do you consciously, though, think you understand it, or are we just as adults thinking that children think they understand it?
I can remember doing things and not telling my parents because I didn't think that they wouldn't understand it. You know, they wouldn't understand. It was too complex for them.
Well, maybe that's just, it's your own world. You know, it's the world of a child is a different world.
But you underestimate that other people... you know, I have intelligence, they can figure things out too.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yes, that's right.
Too tied up in your own world.
Yeah. Mm. So it's, you know, in some ways I thought bits of that book were a bit, you know, a bit too sort of coincidental, you know, the way things collided. But
and the fact that he could go back to help that particular...
Yeah, it just happened to be the person that was committing the crime was the person from the original thing.
Bit too convenient.
Yeah, but I think that idea of things you did as a childhood, you know, we all have memories, I'm sure you all do.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not going to mention them, though. Maybe on my deathbed.
You admitted them to yourself, though.
No, unfortunately, I didn't, no.
Oh, gee.
I think those ideas.
Let's not go there.
Those ideas of, you know, you do things for your own social standing or whatever when you're as a child, and you feel like other people wouldn't understand that. You know, I remember trying to explain things to my mother about what because everybody else is, you know,
Yeah.
And she just wouldn't buy into that at all. But I think when you read about people writing those sort of experiences, it's sort of cathartic because you're there with the rest of society, understand.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and actually, and it probably reminds you when you've forgotten, you know, you've forgotten that, after, you know, because it was so long ago, and it brings you back to, oh, yeah, that's right, that's how I felt. Mm.
And I remember someone telling me, Beta, you probably remember this as an old teacher, that, you know, you had to be careful with... when you were sort of talking to kids about things that they'd done wrong, that you didn't back them into a corner because any cat, when it's cornered, will scratch. And that's true, you know. Mm. Kids tell lies when they feel like they've got no other way out.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, absolutely.
I think books that capture that. Interesting ones.
Was the Kite Runner made into a series or a film?
It was made into a film, yeah.
Yeah, and it was pretty, well, shocking from my memory.
Yeah, because of the child abuse. Yeah, but, yeah. You know. Yeah, there's that scene that is quite shocking.
Yeah.
And he, Khalid Hosseini, so I can't say it, Brian, you'd have to say that. He said he was badgered about whether it was autobiographical because it does match his story in some ways. He was but he disputes that. He doesn't. He just sort of wanted this example of something that a child feels that stays with them their whole life and how redemption is possible for those days. And there's lots of books that have been written like that.
Mm. Yes, well, actually, when Brian said you were going to be talking about this, what is it, Bill Roman? I'd never heard of it before. So I Googled it, but I realised that most of the books, really, that I'd read that were in that genre were, like, I'd read them years and years ago, you know, David Copperfield and things like that. But then I found the one that I had read recently was Tim Winton's Breath. Also was a coming-of-age book about, you know, two young boys in the surfing scene, you know, and just encapsulates that, you know, the young adolescent boys egging each other on to these, and you're sitting there, you're reading it, and you're thinking, no, don't do that. Whatever you do, stay out of the water. But that was the only.
Yeah, they're daring. And I think we might have mentioned this.
Yes, I think this was the genesis of this conversation.
Yes.
Oh, was it?
We just remembered it last week.
We remembered it last week. And we're just talking about how in surf towns you would expect people to be carrying it around under their arm. It's about the boys are Bruce Pike, Pikelet, and his mate Looney.
Looney, yeah.
And they dare each other to perform all these dangerous stunts in the river as children, and as teenagers they take up surfing. And they're adopted by this former professional surfer, Sando, who leads them into new levels of recklessness.
Yes, that theme's interesting note. Too. Yes. The you know, obsession with the you know, the hero, the older hero.
Yes. And it's interesting how Winton can take such a surfing cliche as like the perfect wave and actually make it into a gripping and interesting story.
Yeah, it was.
And Sando, of course, lives on, well, past glories to some extent.
Mm.
And it's about courage, endurance, and whether or not you're actually crazy to be doing all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's about friendship, because all those friendships disintegrate.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Yeah, yes, yes. There are a lot of threads in it, even though, you know, it's in some ways a sort of a, you know, not that much happens, but...
You know, if we were really to draw a long bow, Brian, we could connect this to Footscray, really. It's hard work, but I can think we can get there. That idea of maleness and male friendship and the element of competitiveness that is sometimes there versus the sort of mateship, where the connection in Footscray comes is that idea that what wins is the team, you know, that expression of giving the medal to Bob Murphy sort of epitomised that for everybody, that we're, you know, part of a team. It's a reduction of competitiveness.
Spot on. That's fantastic. No, I don't think that's a long bow at all, actually.
Yes. Somebody will write a book about Luke Beveridge.
No doubt. It's probably been printed as we speak.
Yes, somebody's on to it, you know. And let's hope it's not a pulp, you know, one of those ones they dash out that's full of cliches. But let's hope somebody like Robert Murphy writes it, you know.
Well, you know...
The poet of the halfback flank.
Beveridge is a surfer, so... That sort of, you know,
It's all tying up together here.
No doubt, he's red breath.
Did you hear Dennis Committee's comment right on the siren? This was really funny, because the coach came down onto the ground because the siren was about to go and they were about to win. And he said, it's time for a beverage.
Yeah. He's probably heard that before.
Yes. He might have rehearsed that one, but it was a good one to go out on.
Yes. Lee, I'm interested in this book, which I have not read, The Secret Life of Bees by Sue Monk. What was interesting to you about that?
Look, there were a lot of really interesting things in this. This was a book that my daughter actually had on her reading list at school, and I just picked it up one day to read. It has also been made into a film. I'm discovering all these things when I go back and look them up. I didn't know that was a film.
I saw the film, but I haven't read the book.
Oh, look, it's an interesting story, especially for the modern sort of era, about a girl who basically is abused as a child by her father due to a tragedy that had happened in their lives that she feels she caused. Her mother died, and there's the suggestion, or she feels she's... The bits of the story she's grasped is that she was responsible. She went back and she picked up the gun, and it was her... discharging that gun that killed her mother. So her father is quite poisoned by that experience and treats her very badly. Anyway, she runs away and she seeks shelter with this group of women who are beekeepers. And I thought what was interesting about it is a couple of things towards the end. One is that the women themselves have this sort of cargo cult around this Black Madonna, which is the name for their bee farm, but they actually have this sort of religious chapel, and they meet there and they have this all-female sort of worship session around this Black Madonna. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was really interesting, because it sort of developed that idea of that it doesn't really matter what religion it is. Religion provides comfort for people and companionship. you know, and that's its essential ingredient. So it seems ridiculous to have this cult of the Black Madonna, but that was its purpose. That's what, and the young girl, she gets absorbed into that too, you know, the comfort that it gives her, the singing and the being together and the feasting on their, when they're celebrating. So I thought that was really nice. And of course, the other thing is she does meet up with her father again, who tracks her down. And the book avoids that cloying happy ending.
She'd run away,
yeah,
hadn't she?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, she runs away and she lives with this group of women. Mm. And that sort of, she doesn't actually deal with her memory of the killing of her mother. She keeps that as a bit of a secret. So that's still something she has to come to terms with. But she certainly finds happiness with this group of women. But towards the end, she is forced to confront what happened, and she's forced to confront her father again. But it doesn't have that cloying happy ending.
No.
She doesn't always not forgiven.
No.
You know? And I thought that was good. That it didn't try and go there, that it sort of talked about, she understood how his grief may have caused some of the difficulties that he experienced.
Yes.
You know, and so it's that thing about, like Black Swan Green, understanding the parent, you know, and what motivates others other than yourself.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the journey out of childhood.
Yes, it... Yeah, the understanding of the parent idea is interesting, because sometimes it takes some of us well into our late life in order to understand our parents.
They say that by the age of 35, it's about time to forgive your parents. But I was reminded of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, because that's clearly is about growing up, because... Jean Louise Scout, yes, yeah, and her brother's Jim, isn't it? But anyway, she knows a lot more at the end of that year than she did at the beginning. A lot more. It's kind of, in a sense, a loss of innocence in the sense of innocence as having no knowledge.
And I don't know if you read Go Set a Watchman. But you can see what...
I did.
I mean, it seemed bizarre to me that that was written first, but I sort of felt like I could see what Harper Lee was trying to do. I didn't like it at all, but I thought I could see what she was trying to do, because the older Scout realises that it's Atticus and the stand that he took is far more complex than just he's the good man and all the other people are the bad men. You know?
Yeah, because that's the way it comes across, doesn't it?
In,
So is that the one you just spoke about? Is that one that came out recently that was, that had been sort of kept under wraps for all these years?
Yeah. So she goes, Scout goes back home, and Atticus actually turns out to be not the sort of... he was interested...
perfect.
Yeah, he was interested in the legal process rather than the rights of black citizens.
Yeah.
You know, and then he was...
But it's interesting that... Did she write it first? She wrote Go Set a Watchman
I thought first. That's right. Was the case.
I think she did, So it may be that when she came to write To Kill a Mockingbird, that she made Atticus perhaps a little more admirable than she had first had in mind.
Because that was a more interesting character, really, than the... I mean, the pragmatic Atticus of Go Set a Watchman is not an appealing character, really.
No, he's not.
And it was Cary Grant, wasn't it, in the movie?
Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck, sorry. That's right, it was Gregory Peck, you couldn't make him bad.
Well...
in any way.
Harper Lee thought that he was perfect, which is interesting. Such a powerful film. And I don't know if you remember it all that well, but, I mean, he was as popular as Bob Murphy. But Lee, your other book, Jasper Jones.
Yes, Jasper Jones is a terrific book. It has been referred to as the To Kill a Mockingbird, Australia's To Kill a Mockingbird. It's one that was sort of I'm not sure that it was intended to be young adult fiction, but it's sort of marketed like that. But it's an excellent story, very much along this lines of growing up and coming of age, about a young boy who has a friend called Jasper Jones. Charlie's the boy's name, and Jasper is a sort of, he's an Indigenous character who's a bit of an outcast and sort of considered, you know, bad company, somebody that the others are a bit suspicious of. But anyway, he's a friend of Charlie, and it basically, Jasper gets blamed or hounded for a crime that they assume he's committed. And the reality is that there's many, many more layers to that crime. And Jasper is the target of the police because he's the most obvious person. You know, he's not well looked after. He roams. He's the sort of person that they assume could have done it. But the actual truth of the matter is much darker.
Right.
Secret. But it's it begins with the two boys. Jasper comes and wakes him up and takes him out into the woods to see something, and it turns out to be a body hanging from a branch, a dead body. So it's like, however many pages in, you're like, what?
Yeah, straight into it. Yeah. Well, that sounds good.
Very dramatic. But I thought it was a terrific book because it really, in a way that not many Australian books really do, explore that we have those dark issues in our country towns, as they do in the American South, and they do in lots of other places. But I don't know many books that take that up, really delve into that.
That you've reminded me of Philip Gwynne's Deadly Anna, which was later adapted to film and marketed as Aussie Rules or Australian Rules, I think. But that was very much about growing up in that environment where there was that undercurrent of racism, which people were not quite honest about. And
which is not just in the country towns.
No.
It's really throughout Australia.
Yeah. Yes, that's a great book, I think, Deadly Anna. I thought it was a very, very good book. And it's about football.
Bing! That's hit number three of
And you also read me when, you know, the boys have this secret about a body in the wilderness. That reminds me of Stephen King's Stand By Me.
The film I've seen.
The film. Mm. I'm not sure what the original story was called, but the film was called Stand By Me.
Yeah, I've never read any Stephen King. Is it good?
Oh, look, the film is magnificent. Yeah, about a group of 12-year-old boys discovering some unpleasant truths about the world.
I think books that look at hard issues like that, like The Secret Life of Bees does with that domestic violence, really it is, or child abuse, that try and shine some sort of light, some sort of understanding about how these things can happen, are quite interesting because, you know, otherwise you're reduced to saying, well, there's just bad people and good people, you know, to try and find the situations that might lead us into dark places seems an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, and to be able to express it in a sort of non, you know, sort of sanctimonious way, I guess, is an art.
Yeah, and to make a character that you don't necessarily like, but you might be able to
maybe understand a little. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian Dwyer. With me, Lee Kelly, Deb Bradfield and Tony Webber. Great Expectations is often regarded as the English equivalent of Goethe's Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship. As I said, different interpretations of Great Expectations. Does Pip become... He accepts the norms of English society, and he is disabused, perhaps, of his fondness for status and wealth without moral character. And yet, although Dickens is very strong on, you know, strength of character and earning your money and all that sort of stuff, I wouldn't say it was all that critical of English values, Great Expectations.
No.
I don't think it's, well, it doesn't, there's no critique of imperialism because he's going off to Cairo to make his fortune. So it's as if, you know, Dickens was, you know, just accepted that imperialism was a jolly good thing.
Maybe the thing we need to take about out of Great Expectations doesn't really matter what happens to you as a child. You can be abused and neglected. It'll all end up all right in the rough.
Yes.
That theme runs through a few of Dickens, doesn't it?
Yeah. But a very memorable novel, of course, and perhaps because Miss Havisham has just become a sort of part of folklore, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Sort of bitter old widow.
That's actually all I can remember about that book. It's so long ago that I read it, but I can still see her.
Mm.
Was she covered in cobwebs?
In cobwebs.
She's still got the wedding dress on.
Like a wedding cake in cobwebs. Yes. It was an amazing image.
And there's a recent version of it with Gillian Anderson of the X-Files fame as Miss Havisham, and she is brilliant. But look at some of the other names. There's Joe, of course, but there's Pumblechook. Mrs. Joe, not a pleasant person. Estella, who's, you know, the one, the lovely one.
Yes, that's right.
Bentley Drummy. Dogie Orlick. Dickens was great with names.
Yeah, he was.
The convict is Magwitch.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. It's all coming back to me now.
And the lawyer, Mr. Jaggers.
Yeah.
Just lovely. So Pip apparently overcomes his biases about money, respect and status and matures and reevaluates his life and so on and enters society on the foundation not of snobbery and inherited wealth but hard work. Well, I think that two of my favourites, however, are Jane Austen's Emma. I couldn't read you the first paragraph of Emma because somebody's pinched my copy of the
book. Oh, not again. We've had this. We've had a lot of this. We're going to have to put out a list of most wanted.
But look, I love Emma because she's spoilt and headstrong and self-satisfied and she overestimates her own abilities, especially in finding suitable husbands for Harriet. And she's quite blind to the dangers of meddling in other people's lives.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's the one where she's a matchmaker, isn't it? Yes.
Well, she fancies that she is. And that's her family's the Woodhouse family, and her neighbour is Mr. Knightley, who's always played in the film by some devilishly handsome chap. And Harriet is always played by somebody like Toni Collette or somebody like that. And Mrs. Weston is the woman who's married or remarried later in life, and she's always played by someone charming, like a middle-aged Greta Scacchi or somebody like that. Is it all coming back?
Yes, it is.
And as in every Jane Austen novel, there's a disagreeable clergyman. Mr. Elton.
It was probably true of the society.
You know, a lot of these classics I read as a child in comic form. I don't know whether you remember, there used to be a series of comics called The Classics. And, David Copperfield, I've still got them. I've got them at home, and I was actually going to bring them in to show you one time because they're just fantastic. And, so you get this little, you know, you get the story and then you get sort of excited and want to read the book. So, yeah, it was a very good introduction, and I used to get, I think they came out once a month, and we used to go down to the newsagents and buy one a month, and I always really used to look forward to it.
Yeah. Have you read a couple of my other favourites? James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Oh, years ago.
1916. Look, this is fabulous.
I've got it at home.
Like Jane Austen, for you academic listeners, he uses the free indirect discourse where the third person narrative is written with the character's thoughts. For example, what pleasure he'd found since he came into this world. So Jane Austen pioneered this technique, but anyway, it's a feature of Portrait of the Artist, and the young man is Stephen Dedalus. Dedalus, few classicists, was the man who built the labyrinth to imprison the Minotaur.
Oh, yes. The name from somewhere.
So Joyce, of course, is being very postmodern in 1916 with all these intertextual references.
Oh, my God.
And anyway, it's about growing up and the phases he goes through. He's, as a young man, he has a religious phase. He has a hedonistic phase. He rejects religion on the grounds that it's inconsistent with his philosophy of aesthetics, which indeed is what James Joyce himself did. And in the end, like Joyce, Stephen finds that he can't accept the Catholic Church's interpretation of our place in the cosmos, and he can't accept the petty-mindedness of everybody he knows.
Oh, gosh. So what does he do?
What's he left with?
He goes to live in Switzerland, as you do.
Oh. They're not petty there.
No petty cowbells and fresh air.
Yeah. And, of course, it is an autobiographical novel.
I must read that one again.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think he goes a bit easy on the Catholic Church myself.
Is that a bit autobiographical book?
Yes, it is a bit. There's a book there waiting to be written. And the other one I like is Catcher in the Rye, The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. The infamously reclusive J.B. Salinger, who's never in his life given an interview.
Is that right? Gee.
But
he wouldn't still be alive, surely.
No, he wouldn't be now. It was published in 1951. Interestingly, like To Kill a Mockingbird, this is The Catcher in the Rye is one of the most censored books in American high schools and libraries.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Its themes of rebellion, identity, belonging, loss, alienation, connection, guilt and innocence. Do you remember Stradlater, he gets offended because his pal has this very chauvinistic attitude to women, including a girl that he Holden likes, so falls out with his friend, and he's in trouble at school, so he goes off to New York City for the weekend, and he meets three tourist women, so he thinks, oh, well, you know, young man, I need to find out about women and all this sort of stuff, but they all disappoint him. So he hires a prostitute, but he decides it'd be more interesting to talk to her, and then her pimp comes and beats him up. and then he finds the Robbie Burns poem, The Catcher in the Rye, and he has this sort of fantasy of himself doing good works and saving people, not realising that the catcher in the rye is in fact a bad person. and then he seeks refuge with his English teacher, Mr. Antolini, who might or might not behave inappropriately with boys. And the whole world seems to him to be phony. And the only person he cares about is his younger sister, Phoebe. And that's basically how it ends.
Mm, gee, I can't remember that at all. I have read that years and years ago too, but I don't remember that at all.
It is wonderful.
Revisit that too. Gosh.
Yeah.
That's the trouble with this show.
Just unpacked lots of boxes of books, so I've found all these things. Most, I mean, a lot of those older books that we mentioned tonight are now on the shelves. Yeah, so it's lovely to be able to, they're there and I can go and read them anytime.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be able to go and revisit something you've read and then find a little passage and get involved in it.
Yeah, well, I've just forgotten that sort of story reading. Completely.
Mm. Oh, right.
Well, that's this has been the Bildungsroman edition of the book show.
That's good for trivia nights.
Dungsroman.
Well done. Well done, Deb.
So you can look that up, because I certainly had to. Yes. And I can't say it, but well, I can spell it.
I had to too, but I having looked it up, of course, I remember it, because
it's one of those words that is, you know, only describes one limited thing. Mm. Fascinates me in English, the way you have some words that can only do one thing.
Yes. Yes. But the roman part of it is novel, I found out. Yeah. So that, because we had another one
Romana
of those.
Clef.
That's right, Romana Clef, yes.
Mm, the puzzle, or the key.
Yes, that was All the Light We Cannot See, was it? Or what was that now? I think it was. Yes.
Where there's a mystery to be unlocked.
Mm.
Or is it? No. I'll have to check it again now, Deb. But Romana Clef, is it about where there are identifiable people and the reader has fun identifying?
Yes. No, I know what it was, actually. It was the Cambridge Five. It was that novel about the Cambridge Five.
And Anthony Blunt.
Yeah, which one is, well, it was about Anthony Blunt, but which one is, you know, his boy. And
That's what it is. The Romana a Clef, a novel in which real people or events appear with invented names.
That's right.
Yes. And that was John Banville's.
Yes.
The Untouchable.
Oh, yeah, the three of us got it together there.
We should form a team for this quiz night.
We'll forget it next week. We'll have to do it again.
Well, actually, speaking of quizzes, one of the Jasper book that you spoke about was, in fact, an answer in the Age General Knowledge crossword on Saturday in the paper.
Oh, what was the clue?
It was, you know.
The cryptic.
No, it wasn't in the cryptic. No, I'm still battling with that. I'm three quarters of the way through.
Oh, gosh, well done. All right, time to go. Thank you very much, Lee Kelly, Deb Bradfield.
Thank you,
and
Brian.
Tony Webber.
Are you going to take us out with a few strands of Sons of the West?
Yes, that sounds good.
I would like to, but I might be two whiskeys short of singing you a song.